You're listening to An Englishman in the Balkans.
Welcome to An Englishman in the Balkans, the podcast that takes you on a captivating journey into the heart of Bosnia and Herzegovina and the wider Western Balkans. Each episode, we delve into the rich history, vibrant culture, and hidden gems of this beautiful country. Through engaging conversations and personal anecdotes, we aim to bridge the gap between the Balkans and the rest of the world. So sit back, relax, and get ready to be inspired, entertained, and connected.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe giving us a tip or becoming a member of our podcast family. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for listening. We really do appreciate it.
Hello, this episode is a bit different from normal because I'm replaying a podcast episode that's not mine. Let me explain. Back in May, I was a guest on a fantastic podcast hosted by Slavenka Vukovic-Brian called Two Worlds, One Me. I think the podcast title is pretty explanatory, but basically, my two worlds have been, and still are, the UK and my now adopted home of Bosnia and Herzegovina. Now, many of you have asked me time and time again for me to talk about how I arrived here in Bosnia. And it's a long story, actually. But on Slavenka's podcast, I opened up for the first time. So here's my story.
Hello, this is Two Worlds, One Me, the podcast in which I, Slavenka Vukovic-Brian, talk to interesting people from all over the world who have moved away from the country of their birth to settle and live in another country. Every episode, I ask guests about the worlds that make up their lives, and we have lots of interesting conversations.
My grandmother said, there's people broadcasting radio stations from boats, and it was the ultimate theatre of the mind. I just used to lie there, listening not only to this wonderful pop music, but these disc jockeys talking about their lives on this boat, and you really got engrossed in it.
I hope you enjoy listening. On with the show. My guest today is David Bailey. David Bailey, or as he calls himself, Pejcinovic Bailey. David is a former soldier and broadcaster. As a soldier, he served from 1968 to 1993 in Germany and the UK. His second career as a broadcaster saw him working for BBC and independent radio in the UK and for British forces broadcasting in the UK and the Falkland Islands. He joined the UK Army Reserves in 1996 as a media officer serving in Bosnia and Herzegovina from late 1998 to 2005. He then led media projects in Canada, Kosovo, and Afghanistan, and after that, as a media trainer in Ethiopia and South Caucasus. His base since 2005 has been a village in the northwest of Bosnia and Herzegovina called Čardačani, where he says he is happiest. Now, a couple of interesting facts about David. David climbed the two highest peaks in Ecuador back in 1989. He was awarded the Queen's Commendation for Valuable Service in 1999 and made an MBE in 2002, both of that for services in the former Yugoslavia. He speaks, he says, passable German, and he says he struggles with the languages of Bosnia and Herzegovina, though I know that he can certainly get by. Now, personally, I have discovered David through searching for interesting podcasts that cover the Balkans and the former Yugoslavia. And I listened to so many amazing and interesting conversations that he had with lots of interesting people in the region and all over the world. His podcast is called Englishman in the Balkans. He also has a blog with the same name and Instagram as well. Welcome to my podcast, David.
Well, it's really, really nice to be with you today. I think maybe my weather is slightly better than yours. We have the trees outside are full of blossoms, which means we're going to have tons of fruit and we're going to be able to make liters and liters of rakia, which I think you will identify with.
Absolutely. I know what rakia is. Yes, fantastic. Great that you have such wonderful weather. Well, it has been raining recently, although I think it's going to be sunny this coming weekend, which is fantastic. Now, David, what are your two worlds? How do you define your two worlds?
My two worlds are, one, the world that I grew up in, which was the United Kingdom. And my second world is the world that is now my home and will remain my home for the rest of my life, which is not only the Western Balkans, but a particularly special to me part of the Western Balkans, which is Bosnia and Herzegovina. And my second world, if you will, I always describe as a very heart-shaped, which Bosnia and Herzegovina is, but very misunderstood place. So those are my two worlds.
You're listening to An Englishman in the Balkans.
Hi, and dobrodošli. My name is Ivana, and I'm the heart and soul behind the Balkansis podcast, coming to you all the way from beautiful Australia. As a former refugee, I've walked the path of resilience and transformation. My mission, to empower Balkan women and men to heal, thrive, and grow through my coaching and mentoring programs. Join me on this incredible journey of self-discovery, community, and belonging. Together, we'll rewrite our stories and move forward towards a brighter future. Balkansis Podcast, your source of authentic stories, inspiration, and wisdom. Ready to make a difference? Dive in and follow us today.
You say you were born in England. Could you tell us a little bit more about your childhood, where you were born, and what your memories from that time are?
I was born back in 1953 in West London, in Kensington, in West Kensington, which at that time, just a few years after the Second World War, had a lot of large, spacious apartments. I remember that, flats. My father was a police officer. My mother worked for the London Underground. I just remember growing up in this massive flat. My father used to come home on his police bicycle and cycle down the hallway that went straight through where all the rooms were on left and right. It was amazing.
Amazing size for London.
Yes. I think when I went back last time, it is now into seven small flats. But back then it was one huge place. We lived in the basement, but I was able to look out of my bedroom and go to the windows in the early mornings to hear the household cavalry riding along North End Road. I always remember there was a soldier in his brown uniforms. They sat in the middle on a horse, and they had one on either side, and they were exercising the horses every morning. And that has struck me forever. I have to say that when I got to seven, we moved into the suburbs, a place called Hounslow West, which at that time was at the end of the Underground, the Piccadilly line, and moved into, I don't know, the quintessential suburban, three up, two down, semi-detached. And I suppose my life, from what I remember then, was being out where there were trees and fields. Yeah, I'm a London boy. I do get nostalgic at times. You can't help it. I watch TV here in Bosnia and see things like Morse and all the other police series. And, you know, I can actually say, I remember that street. No, that never used to be like that. But apart from that, the nostalgia is the only thing that connects me with home now. I do have children from my first marriage, but of course they too are like me. They also have two worlds for each of them.
How interesting that is, that they also have that. So what are your earliest school memories?
I remember going to primary school. I was an only child then. My brother and sister hadn't come along at that time. They didn't come along until I was nine. But my earliest things, it was all about wearing school uniforms. I remember I hated wearing a school cap. I was always anxious at school. I wasn't too fond of the regimentation of it. It was very regimented back there. I was a bit of a boisterous boy, a bit of a little devil, I suppose, and that has been with me through the whole of my life. And I was always getting into what I would consider just like silly little things, making fun, drawing funny pictures on the board with chalk. They had corporal punishment back there. I saw the cane more than I should have done, which was very painful.
Oh, dear, yes.
That jaundiced my attitude towards my education. So my primary school is where it started, and then it went on through secondary education. Maybe that is the reason that I joined the army at such a young age that I did.
What did you want to be when you grew up? What were your first sort of thoughts? Oh, I would like to be...
In no particular order, train driver, pilot. I wanted to be a soldier. Both my grandfathers have been in the British Army. My father, during the Second World War, had annoyed the family by joining the Royal Air Force. I always felt that the best storytellers in your life are your grandparents. They're the first ones that tell you those stories. Say here that grandmother tells you the story of your country, but very rarely is it factually correct. It's full of legends and myths and things. But I had this thing about being a soldier. And my father said, that's a lot. You'll do that over my dead body.
Why was he not interested?
I think because it was the attitude that my grandfather, his father, had had to him. His father had served in the Great War in the trenches and did not want his son to go through the same thing. So when the Second World War came along and my dad was of age, he ran away and joined the Royal Air Force and said, well, I'm not going to be in the trenches, I'll be in an aircraft. It's the same thing. It's a lot of danger, right? And I think that my dad didn't want me to go through the same thing. But I had been not indoctrinated, but massively influenced by both my grandfathers. One side of my grandparents were Irish that had left Ireland during the early 1920s. My family were what they called free staters. They weren't total Republicans, so they came over. So I had this huge Irish impact. I've managed to have a recording of my Irish grandmother, and I play it. It's my party piece. I play it, and people here, for example, in this country and back in the UK, say, what is she saying? I don't understand a word. And but I understood it. So I had that, and I think my dad didn't want me to go through the same thing. So being a soldier was one. And when I was 11, I went to my Irish grandparents one Sunday, and I was listening to this pop music on the radio. They had these old-fashioned valve radios, the things that you switched on, and you had to wait 2 or 3 minutes until they warmed up. And there was this pop music. And of course, back then in 1964, we didn't have pop music on British radio. We only had half an hour a week on the BBC. A lot of people don't understand that now.
So it was quite a treat.
Yes. And then there were these fast talking disc jockeys, as I found out they were. And my grandmother said, there's people broadcasting radio stations from boats. And it was the ultimate theater of the mind. I just used to lie there listening not only to this wonderful pop music, but these disc jockeys talking about their lives on this boat, and you really got engrossed in it. And I thought, I want to be one of these people. I want to do this. Of course, at the age of 15, trying to get a job on board a boat 3 miles off the Essex coast was a little bit beyond me. So, yeah, I opted to become an apprentice tradesman in the British Army at the age of 15.
Very young.
But it wasn't all fun, if I were to be honest with you. There was a lot of bullying, and I had to grow up quickly. But, yeah, I stayed there from the age of 50 until I was 40.
Wow, that's amazing, amazing. So what sort of jobs did you do in that period?
Well, I joined the army as an apprentice electronic tradesman. And that meant I went back to school, which was the thing I was trying to get away from.
It always catches up with you in the end, the schooling, doesn't it?
That's if only I'd known back then. I sort of like jumped from the frying pan into the fire. Yeah, I don't think I was too academically strong, if I can use that phrase. And before my course ended, I'd opted to change trade. They said, well, you can go to Germany and have a look at what other people do in the army. What would you like to do? I said, I'd like to be a surveyor with the Royal Artillery. So I ended up in Celle in northern Germany, expecting at the age of 17, I was then, to see what surveyors did. And would that be a good trade to learn in the army? Except I ended up for 6 months on the streets of West Belfast, which was my actual coming of age. That's where I learnt about life in 6 months. It was 1971.
That was a difficult time, 1970s.
Pretty traumatic. My unit had the first deaths from the IRA, and we were being bombed and all the rest of it. But in all honesty, Slavenka, at the age of 17, I was living a Hollywood action movie. It wasn't until it was all over that, and I came down from it, that I realized, goodness, David, do you realize what's just happened? My perspective on life changed for that. I then became a mechanic. I went to a place called Hildesheim in Germany to work with self-propelled artillery. That's where I met my first wife. Then I moved around fixing tanks until I realized that, yeah, I didn't want to be a mechanic anymore. I went back on another course to England. Elke, my wife at the time, moved with me. And rebellious David, as I was in the army, I think I spent more time on restricted privileges than I did having a normal life. I just used to enjoy winding up everybody in the army. You know, it was just like, I had to do it. I was a sergeant major's nightmare, or actually a sergeant major's dream. To have somebody like me in his company was like a gift from heaven.
Yes, breath of fresh air.
Breath of fresh air. I used to hate all these sergeant majors, and I just wanted to make their lives more miserable. Funny old thing, though, I progressed up the ranks very quickly, and in 1984, I was the youngest company sergeant major in the British Army. I'd actually been what I really detested, quite weird.
How interesting is that? But what is it that made you rebellious? What do you think? Why do you have that need to be rebellious?
That's an amazingly good question. I just find that, you know, everything being regimented stunts you as a person. I'll try and explain it by saying that when I left the military, I went into a career where you needed to be creative. And it was there that the penny dropped with me that at school, in the military, being creative meant that you thought for yourself, that you had an opinion, and that you wanted to change things. And that doing that rocks the boat. And society doesn't like people normally who rock the boat. And so maybe that's why I was always being caned at school. Maybe, I don't know. But I felt that it stunted people. I needed to rebel against it. It was like listening to these radio stations. These guys on boats were rebelling against the British establishment. We always said when I was a kid that we had free media. We didn't have free media. The BBC told you, you know, you didn't listen to pop music all day. You will get 30 minutes of pop music a day and you'll be grateful that you got it. So I suppose I identified with that. Now, at the age that I am, the wrong or the right side, depending on what day of the week it is, of 60, I'm still rebellious. People laugh at me. I wear odd socks. I wear coloured odd socks. Some days I shave, some days I don't. Should I shave? I don't know. But I get, I don't know, perverse pleasure of watching people say, really, you should shave. And I like to say, why?
Exactly. Yes, yes. Interesting. Yeah. I love the creativity element. I really do love that because they do say that education kills creativity. I don't know whether you've listened to Sir Ken Robinson when he talks about this. There's a very famous TED talk where he really gives examples similar to what you just illustrated, that, you know, you want to be a little bit different, but you get sort of smacked on your fingers for that. Or you want to do something that is fun, different from what you're being told at school, and it somehow should not be done. And by not letting people use this force they have within them, which is a creative force, you actually, you know, by educating them, you're killing that creativity. By killing creativity, obviously, you're not gaining different insights into the world that you can. So it's a very interesting TED talk by Sir Ken Robinson. And I can certainly see you as an example of that. So, David, then how did the world bring you to other countries than Germany? How did you get into Ethiopia and other places?
I finished my army career that had been based mainly in Germany and the United Kingdom. Back then, before the wall came down, some of my friends in the military left the United Kingdom and, apart from going back for the occasional course, spent a whole 25 years in Germany. There were some soldiers that, having done that, they never came back at all. I've talked to a few this week, people that I knew, and I said, did you ever go home? And they went, no. But after my military career, I kept in touch with media. I'd volunteered with the British Forces Broadcasting Service. It's a really long story, but to cut it short, I got offered a job at British Forces Radio. Someone said that I had some talent, and I applaud them for that because I was able to do the second thing that I wanted to do as a boy. Some people don't get the option to do even one thing they wanted to do as a child, and I've done both of mine. For that, I think I'm a very lucky man.
Mm.
So I went there. I worked in London presenting radio programs. Then I went for a 7-month detachment to the Falkland Islands. That was quite an eye-opener. I mean, like most people, I always thought the Falkland Islands as a boy was north of Scotland, right? I never understood that it was at the south of South America. So I managed to go there. And yes, at that time I was working as well for independent local radio, BBC and independent. I fell into hard times. I tried to set up my own media business only to realize that I had no business acumen at all. Ran out of money very quickly. I got myself into a bit of a stitch and looked for a way out. And that was to join what was then the Territorial Army, who accepted me in as a media officer. I just wanted to go and be a sergeant major somewhere, to be honest with you. But they said, you know, you've got these media skills. Will you join this group? It's called the Media Operations Group. They don't exist anymore. And I did an interview and was accepted. And so during the weekends and 2 weeks a year, I used to go away and do military stuff as a captain. And they commissioned me. That was quite a shock. But nevertheless, I enjoyed that. And I noticed that my colleagues, some used to be away for months at a time. And I said, well, where are they gone? And somebody said, oh, one's in Rwanda or one's somewhere else doing these special projects. And I said, well, how do you get a special project? And the major said to me, well, David, you just asked me. And I said, I'm asking, have you got anywhere for me to go? And she said, yes, in 3 weeks, we need a spokesperson in Sarajevo in Bosnia-Herzegovina.
And what year was that?
This is 1998.
Right.
And I said, I'm your man. So I went home to a very disgruntled wife. My marriage was not doing too well at the time. And said, I've got myself a job as a media spokesperson in Sarajevo for 6 months. Yeah. And I arrived not in Sarajevo, but a place that I'd never heard of called Banja Luka. It's the second biggest city in Bosnia-Herzegovina.
Yeah.
At the headquarters of the multinational division, the framework of which was British. I said, so when do I start my media spokesperson's job? And they went, there isn't a job like that. We want you to get the BBC news, rewrite it, put a spin on it, attribute it to the BBC, and then get it out to local radio stations. I said, I'm really sorry, I can't do that. It's morally, ethically, and legally wrong.
What do they mean by the spin?
Well, I think we take it now. It's like create fake news.
Oh, right. Okay. Right.
That's what we would call it now.
Right.
And I said, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not prepared to do that. And one of the officers that had briefed me on doing this said, that's not the answer we were looking for. I then saw that I was going to be sent back to the UK, except the general said, well, what do you think we should do? Yeah. And I said, well, knowing how senior officers worked, I knew how to answer it. I said, first, General, I need some time to think about it and to come up with a plan. He said, good. That's what he was expecting to hear, right? And how long will it take? And I said, 7 days. You never say one day because nobody comes up with a plan in one day. You can't make an appreciation of the situation, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So I said, yeah, well, let's work on an idea. And I went back and said, we're going to make a one-hour music-based radio show talking about what the Stabilization Force is doing in Bosnia and Herzegovina. It'll be done in the local language, and then we'll put it on CDs. Do you remember those things, CDs? And then we'll send it to radio stations around the country, and we'll pay them to play it. So that's what happened. It was called Horizonte, which means horizons. And it was an hour long, and I found a young girl who was an interpreter with a very bubbly personality to present it. And everything was going gorgeously until 1999, when NATO bombed Serbia, and nobody wanted to take the program. So what to do? And the general said, well, nobody wants to take it. What are we going to do? And I said, well, it's quite easy. If you have the money, I'll put a transmitter on the end of the studio, and let's turn it into our own radio station. So we did. And from those, let's say mid-1999 until 2005, there was a radio station broadcasting across the north of Bosnia-Herzegovina. It was called Oxygen, a word that worked in each of the three languages of Bosnia and Herzegovina, which is strange, isn't it? You know, we have 4.5 million people in this country all up, and they have three different languages. which actually, in my humble opinion, are all exceedingly similar, apart from the occasional word or whatever. Yes. But it worked for them. And I created a European-sounding radio station with young radio presenters playing the latest Western music, nothing local, no news, because young people didn't want news. And we gave them talk shows where they'd have platforms to discuss what they wanted, not what the international community wanted. And it was an outrageous success.
Give me some sort of idea of what the show was about. What would you play?
We were the first radio station in the region that I wanted it to have an impact. Nobody played the music that they wanted. We had a computerized system in. We only had 250 songs. It's a bit like Heart FM in England at the moment. So the music was very familiar. The presenters were very fast speaking. They only spoke for 35, 40 seconds between music. That was during the day to keep people occupied. We broadcast 24 hours a day. But every evening we would have a three-hour talk show. And we would put topics in that we felt we could get responses off the younger people. The British military have this approach of key leader engagement. So you talk to the older people. Right? Which is a recipe for disaster because old people do not change their minds. So the young people were going to do it. And to give you an example, we're trying to get ethnic tolerance between the young people who have come from families that have had a nightmare of an experience for 3.5 years during the conflict. So what do you do? How do you get them to talk to each other? So we came up with things, and this is my example. Why is Bosnia so useless at football when the former Yugoslavia had one of the leading football countries in the world?
Right.
And, of course, this is a topic. Why are we so useless at football? And these young people are ringing in saying, well, we used to be one of the top five footballing nations in the world, right? But now we have six different football teams because the country had broken up.
Yeah.
Just remember, we had this guy, this guy, this guy. And one of the people said, and if we had people like this again, it would be fantastic. Now, this listener, this young man that rung in was from a town called Prijedor, which is not too far away from Banja Luka. Pretty Serbian in a way. Quite extreme Serbian place in a way. I'm being diplomatic here, right?
Okay.
And the next person said, let me tell you, the football he was talking about was a Muslim. We don't need Muslims. And there was this all anti-Muslim rhetoric. And my presenter was there quite scared. We had the microphone down and I said, Dragan, just go with it and just do at the end of this what I told you to do, please. When this man had finished this vitriolic outburst, Dragan said, well, you have the right to have your view. I don't particularly agree with it. And here's Alison Moyet, right? And there's another piece of music playing. And then the next person ran in and said, I come from Prijedor, I'm a Serb, and that is a person that's giving us a bad name. We should all be working together. It's the only way that we're going to take this country forward out of the horror that our parents left it to us. And then it just rolled on from that. And we learned from situations like that how healthy it can be for young people to discuss. It's not for us as internationals to put them down. That was the basis of the radio station. And I brought Boy George over, who's a DJ at the time. And we tried to open the window because that's what people wanted.
Yeah, giving them a platform to voice their views.
To see how younger people were doing things in the Western world. And when we talked about corruption, we would never have examples about Bosnian political corruption. We would find stories, for example, from Canada. You know, to say to them, you're not the only people. Other people do it too. And this is how they cope with it. So that was my Bosnian experience. I had in 1993 dropped into the country for 3 weeks and experienced a bit of the horrors. So when this task was given to me in 1998, I was able to identify with it. 2005, I left. I went to Canada. I was invited to Canada by one of my former commanding generals who was a Canadian. We set up a radio station, just like Oxygen, but a dual language radio station, Dari and Pashto, and we broadcast into Kandahar province to try and do the same thing. Were we as successful? Jury's out on that. After that, then I went to Kosovo. Once again, trying to replicate what Oxygen did. It didn't work there, I'm being totally honest. Then I spent a year in Kabul. And having had missiles fired over me three or four times, I thought that the joke had run thin by then. And I wanted to come home, and home was here. People wanted me to do media training, especially digital media training. And I went to Ethiopia. That's how I got there, for a four-week opportunity to work there. And then I did a two-year project visiting the countries of the South Caucasus, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia. But I was always based here, going to and from, making fleeting trips to back to Germany, to Oberammergau, to talk to NATO. So that's how I was tripping around the world, doing something that I love. Once again, a very, very lucky David.
Yeah, sounds like that, yes. With obviously different challenges you've had along the way, you were always able to take the path that you actually enjoyed and liked and have passion for. I expect that at that point you found new love as well as new country. Is that correct? 2005-ish?
Would that be? No, 2002-ish. Actually,
okay.
I managed to stay as long as I did with the army. You could only normally do 6 months and then you had to leave.
Yeah.
In exceptional circumstances, 1 year. But this project that I was doing was going so well, and I proved that continuity was the key, that I was kept on in uniform. But at the end of it, they said, you know, we can't do this anymore. We'd like to re-roll you as a civilian working for the British Army. And I took that and had moved off the base. Behind the wire no longer. And that was very good for my work because I actually got to see the truth of what local people were going through, how they lived. I was fascinated by the culture anyway. And then I met Tamara. She I had a radio program every Sunday, right? The reason I did 3 hours on a Sunday was I had to do it so that my team knew when the boss said they'd done it wrong, that I could do it too. I believe in leading by example. And at one of these parties, I said, if you ever want to come up and say hello, do that. And somebody did, but we were in the middle of rigging up this outside broadcast. I think I was a bit short. I was polite, but I was a bit short. And this person left and walked away. And I just felt so guilty about it. And through a quite an unusual way, Tamara said, well, you owe me a coffee. And as you said before to me, and the rest is history. Yeah, so we were together 17 years. She'd been married before. We said we would never do it again. And then one day whilst watching Netflix, we both decided to get married. So, yeah.
Fantastic.
So now I'm here married again and equally happy. So, again, David is a very lucky person, right?
Absolutely. Sounds like it. Fantastic. Life has a mysterious way. So now that settling in period in your new environment, how was it? How were you accepted as a civilian there? How were you accepted as a local in Bosnia?
I suppose the first way to start answering this is having to react to the question, are you an MI6 spy? Which I laugh at now, but it took me some time to work on that. Look, the people of the Western Balkans, in my humble opinion, are the most hospitable people in the world. And regardless of your background, and you'll know this word yourself, Slavenka, I am a stranac, I am a foreigner. Whether I will be totally accepted before I die, I really don't think that will ever work. I can go a huge way to being accepted, right? But truly 100%, I don't think I could push it that far. But people accepted me and were confused. Why confused? Because they would say, David, we're all trying to run away from this country and you come here. What? And I say, well, yeah, because you don't understand it. You have this beautiful life. Yes. Do you all have money? Of course you don't. Is there huge amounts of political corruption? Of course there is. Is the country totally dysfunctional? Without a shadow of a doubt. But you have the most beautiful country here with eight microclimates, more waterfalls than Germany, France, Italy, Spain, and Portugal put together. Mm. Everybody has fruit trees. You know, you go to the market, everything is fresh. Yes, the tomatoes might not be totally round, but when you bite into them, it is definitely not something that you get in Tesco's in Reading. You know, you actually taste something and you have this. Don't you understand that you have family values that we've lost back where I've come from? And this confuses them. For me, initially, I was very frustrated. You know, for example, you book a holiday. It may have cost you £2,000, £3,000, £4,000. And then your second uncle twice removed has died. Well, in Britain, we would send a card and say, here's my condolences. And you would disappear on holiday. Here, you turn up at the funeral. Who cares about your holiday that, you know, that you've lost all the money on? Because they're so family orientated. And I found that exceedingly frustrating to start off with. You know, why do we have to, Tam, why do we have to go and see your mother again? We only saw her yesterday. Because because that's what we do. My uncle's having coffee with some friends and he wants us to be there. I've got some work to do today. And she never says this, but, you know, you can see her eyes saying, read my lips, we are going to my uncle, right? And so you do. It's taken me the best part of my first 12 years to get that far, get to understand that, to anticipate what is going on. Because my neighbours look like me to a degree, they dress like me. But that is where the similarity ends. The thought pattern, what they prioritize is not, I now prioritize the same as them, strangely, I'll admit it.
Well, that's interesting. I was going to ask you, has that changed? So you said you were initially frustrated with all this. Does it mean you no longer are?
80% I no longer am. There are still sometimes when my Britishness, if I can put it that way, comes out, but it disappears within 5 or 10 minutes. There are things that I am obligated to do, and I have to do it because up until recently, I used to call myself an in-betweener. I was not a tourist, but I wasn't a citizen. So I live in this particularly cocooned world culturally. I have the best of both. So, for example, for Easter, here in the village or here at home, we have Easter lunch for my immediate family. So Tamara's immediate family, Tam will make hot cross buns. And people like eating hot cross buns, right? And we have lots of Britishness in our meal as best as we can. And we also make 40% more food than we can consume because I have to give it to my neighbours.
Yes.
Right? So that will go out there. So that's my Easter. But you do know that in 10 days' time, we have a second Easter because my village is Serbian Orthodox in the main. So I have to be aware of all these different things. And I accept the fact that my neighbours and my family here now, my Bosnian family, they don't necessarily understand what I'm about. Right. So I have to accept that because I'm in their country. Right. They love it. Yes. I mean, her niece, Tamara's niece, she's now 19. When we came to English Easters up until she was 17, there's Easter egg hunts in the garden. There's all this, which does not happen here.
No.
Right. So there's the two cultures. On the 6th of May, here in my house, all my neighbors, everybody's coming. Why? Because it's a coronation of my new sovereign. And they love that. Right. So I'm trying to illustrate the fact that I jump between two cultures and where I know mine pretty well, I'm now year on learning more about how I should behave, how I can no longer say, oh, please excuse me, I'm English. I can't get away with that anymore.
Well, that's very, very interesting. What I find also quite fascinating is that you are wanting and you feel the need to keep and showcase your culture to the locals too. Is that right? You like to show them what your culture is and share so that they can understand you better and see where you come from.
I do it because mm-hmm. people, especially in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and I am generalizing, they have the inability to understand that they could have caused their own problems. It's always somebody else's problem. Somebody else did this, and that's why we're in the situation that we are. And sadly, and sadly, the United States of America and Britain are normally the major culprits. Look what you have done. You know, blah, blah, blah. I've tried to say, well, no, that's not the way it is. And that's never worked. And so I tried to say, you know, my culture is not an unhealthy culture where I come from. It has plus points. For example, my Serbian neighbors at one stage said that you know, Brits, you hate Serbs. And I'm saying, well, I don't know how you can say that because we're related, right? The Crown Prince is a distant relative of today's British sovereign, King Charles. He was at the funeral of Queen Elizabeth and attending the coronation. And then they come and they, like, when I remember when Prince William got married, all my neighbors came and they said, what's Cara Georgia doing there? And I went, because he's part of the family. I told you that we were related. And then now they sort of like come off it and they now say, I understand it. And it was quite surprising that my Bosnian family, who are multi-culti anyway, within this multi-culti framework of Bosnia, they're multi-culti within multi-culti. When Her Majesty, on the day of Her Majesty's funeral, they were here for the whole 12 hours watching it on British TV and asking questions. What about this? What about that? So people...
Did that feel good for you to see that sort of kind of support to some extent?
Yeah, I looked at it as being that now you understand me a little bit more. Now you understand me a little bit more. And like Tamara said, what are we doing for the coronation? Right? I never brought up the subject. So you can see, her mother said, what's David doing for his king's coronation? So it's like they've accepted me with my cultural baggage because I accept their, well, they don't have baggage, they're in their own country, right? But you know what I'm trying to say?
Yes, yes. Well, that tolerance and that sort of culture sharing is crucial, I think, for anything to work. Yeah, yeah. So how do you define home? What is home to you, David?
Home for me is where I feel safe and where I feel as happy as I can be as a human being. It's only been the last 5 years, I'll be totally honest with you. But when I have flown back to the UK and descending through the clouds on the approach into Heathrow, I no longer have a heartbeat.
Oh, okay.
That raises and says, oh, look at this. I no longer point out to myself, oh, yeah, there's the O2. Oh, there's, you know, and places that I remember. I just look outside and there is no feeling. But on the return journey, although I can't fly into the aerodrome at Banja Luka, I descend into Zagreb. And as we come through the clouds, my heart starts to beat. I'm home. And I know, you know, that the housing is built slightly different in Croatia to what it is here in Bosnia-Herzegovina. I understand that. Then when I land and when you get into arrivals and you start hearing Croatian, they're all familiar sounds, although the Croatian language is slightly different from the Bosnian language. I know that. But the thing is, it's that whole, how do you say it, familiarity comes back. I'm sure that if anybody was to observe me, my shoulders go down. I'm feeling less stressed. Then I get on this rickety old bus that goes for 3.5 hours from Zagreb back to Banja Luka, where they play the most, please excuse me, Narodna musica, folk music in Bosnia, can drive you into an asylum. And it's and nobody can, they don't understand moderate. It's either cranked up on that radio, right? And I spend 3.5 hours, and where I used to be irritated by it now, I actually hum along to some of it. Can you believe
that's
that?
Wow. Amazing, David. Wow. So it's all about feelings, isn't it? The home is all about feelings for you.
It is. I've been living something and trying to put a word on it. Bosnia-Herzegovina has got a lot of influence from the 483 years of occupation by the Ottoman Turks. So that is reflected in the wonderful food that is available here. And to a certain degree, a lot of words that were left behind when they left. And one of those is called chafe.
Yes, yes. Tell me a little bit about chafe. Yes.
Chafe is this, I think the modern Western word for, or phrase rather, for chafe is living in the moment, right? Mm-hmm. So sitting down with your coffee. And if you're enjoying your coffee, you don't want to be disturbed. You're chafing, I suppose I could use that word. And you sit there for 1, 2, 3 hours, right? So for me, I have unknowingly adopted a pretty chafe lifestyle. I am less stressed every day. Yeah, and it's me, basically.
Yes, that's very interesting. So I noticed in your blog that you recently visited your mum in Norfolk. How does it feel visiting your family?
Yeah, my mum's 94 and getting frailer by the week, but that's life. I go up there, I see my mum, and she likes to reminisce. She's in that part of her life where it's all just living in the past. And yeah, I go back and we talk about what it was like years ago. The house is just like it always was. She did live and still lives in a doll's house. You know, it's immaculate. It's clean, even at her age, and all her knickknacks and everything else like that.
But does that feel sentimental to you at all? Do you feel connected to that at all?
Less sentimental now than it used to be. She came to Bosnia-Herzegovina on two occasions, so she knows what life is like here. She knows that this is where I'm going. I suppose for all those years when I was in the military, you know, when I left at 15, I was an independent soul. My mum and I have had this very special connection. She's over the moon when I come back, but she's not disappointed when I leave. I had thought at one stage, how would I ever cope if she says, please don't go, please stay. But she's never done that. She still wants to give me things that I can take back. And I take them and then I leave them with somebody because at the moment you can't take all the liquids and the foods.
What does she give you to take?
She, you know, take some sausages. I bought them in Tesco's or whatever. And I'm saying, you can't take meat products. Oh, you'll find a way. You always have. Well, David can't find a way through customs with that, right? But she still has this maternal thing for me, which I find typically mum. But yeah, when mum has gone, and it's not going to be too much longer, that will be the final pin, not nail, pin that links me with the United Kingdom. There won't be any reason to go back anymore. And yeah, might sound sad, but I don't feel sad. And sometimes I feel guilty about that. Maybe I should be more not like that.
So when you think about these two cultures, predominantly two, although you've had Germany and other countries as well, is sort of part of your life. So, but when you think of these two particular worlds, what has each of the world done to you? How have they created you, the person that you are today?
I think from the United Kingdom, I got to understand about people can be what they want to be within their life. They have the opportunity that not a lot of countries in the world have to do what you want to do. That, strange as it may seem with recent events, that the rule of law is dominant. I do feel that the British, regardless of all the problems that we've had, is still a country that cares about its people through the rule of law and is reasonably socially caring. So I like to have that in my attitude to people, thinking about other people rather than me. From Bosnia and Herzegovina, my other world, my newer world, is that, I don't know, there's no pressure here. And I like that. Although there is a view from a lot of people, and I've seen it, that Balkan people suffer tremendously because lots of expectations are put on children. You will go to faculty. You will do this. You will do that. And if you fail at anything, it's shame on you. What will the neighbors think? There is that. But on the other hand, they have a much more relaxed lifestyle. I don't know if there's statistics to prove this, but my assumption is that people live a lot longer in the country where I now am than anywhere else, because even with all the stuff they've gone through, their stress levels are still lower. And I think that says a lot. That really does.
Why do you think that is? Having gone through the war, through all kinds of changes, and still their stress levels are low, what do you think contributes to that?
I think what contributes to it is a phrase that I hear so very often, and a phrase that I use myself very often. Why are we in this situation? Blah, 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 blah. And it's this, Steier Tuya, which basically translated is, it is what it is.
What it is, yeah.
And I think that word, you hear it so often, Steier Tuya. It is what it is, David. What can we do to change it? We just get on with it. So, for example, we have power cuts here in the village quite a lot. You can be watching television. You can be in the middle of cooking something that is exceedingly special to you, and then it's gone. Initially, all those years ago, I would be ranting. How can this happen? This is the 21st century, blah, 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 blah. And yet Tamara says, and immediately walks off, finds some candles, lights it. We have a wood burner in the living room. We set that up. We put some water on there, and we make ourselves some coffee, and we just sit down, and we spend the next hour, two, 3 hours, you know, until bing,
chafing.
Chafing. And then bing, the light comes back on, and the food is ruined, and it is over the fence. That's gone. We'll start again. When I was young, before I came to Bosnia-Herzegovina, I could never have had, you know, like, hey, laid back. I'm not saying I am totally laid back, but before I would have been ranting.
So having moved from culture to culture so many times in your life, do you regret anything?
No, I have no regrets about anything at all, because I've gone through different cultures, different experiences and everything. And I believe that I should enjoy that. I should take all the best parts that I've experienced and try to work on that and totally ignore the negatives. I've picked up little things from, you know, Ethiopia as well. I've seen how some of those people live in awful circumstances and yet they smile. You know, they're sitting in a in a puddle of water with nothing and yet they're truly smiling at you. And I used to think to myself at that time, how can you do that? I even felt one day I didn't do it, but I thought, I need to sit, I need to get dressed in my best clothes and just sit in a puddle for an hour and see if I can smile. When things are getting on top of me, as they do with everybody, I sometimes think about that. You could be sat in a puddle, David, with nothing. And all you're worrying about is that you don't have, you know, there's I don't know, something in the flour. We have lots of bugs that get into the flour here in the village. And, you know, your 4 kilos of flour has gone bad. So what? Did anybody die? No. Is it going to, it's not going to change anything.
Yes. Putting things into perspective.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, I say to my children who are grown up, you know, life is going to throw you curveballs. Just get on with it. But take all the positives and ignore the negatives. I have no regrets at all. And I think that's very important because having regrets just takes up more emotional energy, doesn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a negative sort of energy. You say that your children have also moved to different countries and have different cultures in their lives. Do you think you might have inspired that?
Not sure. My eldest daughter, Natalie, has lived in Hong Kong. She's back in the UK now working. Her plan is that she's on the move in 4 years to join her sister. My youngest daughter is married. She lives now in New Jersey. I follow their adventures. I'm going to see them next month. My two grandsons now make fun of their parents and are about to make fun of me because of my British accent, because they speak with a New Jersey accent. My eldest daughter, my two granddaughters, Natalie is going to move to New Jersey. And my son, and I got a second granddaughter, another granddaughter yesterday, and I have a grandson there. So Christopher lives in Singapore. And, you know, so that they've done that. And I think that they're comfortable moving about and seeing other things. And I think they're comfortable because of something that I didn't realize all those years ago. I said, you know, what it must be like being from a multicultural family. I mean, how do people cope with that? And do you know what my youngest daughter said? What are you talking about, Dad? We're half German. And I had never, ever thought about that in my life. And I went, wow. And when it came to Brexit, what are you going to do, Dad? I'm going to stay in Bosnia. More's the point, darling. What are you going to do? Well, if it all goes wrong, we can get a German passport through Mum, can't we?
Interesting, because, yes, their mum is German. So have they visited you in Bosnia, your children?
Yes, they have.
What do they think?
They just felt it was a blast, right? They just say, this is like amazing. Look at all this. And all the thing, you know, I take them sightseeing and there's wonderful things to see here. And the food absolutely is to die for, right? So they enjoy that, but they enjoy having their own freedom, which I respect as well. So I will go to New Jersey. I'll spend 10 days with them, have a lot of fun and come away. I don't think they would sit comfortably living in Bosnia-Herzegovina because, you know, everybody is so close and I think they like their space.
Yeah, well, there's no right or wrong. It's just different. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what would be your lessons from what you have learned in moving from one culture to another? What would you advise other people when they want to move away from the country of their birth to settle and live in another culture?
I think I would say to people that were thinking of leaving their first world to go to their second world is take your initial world thoughts and your cultural practices and put them in the suitcase underneath your clothes so that they're the last things that you take out. When you go to another country, you are an immigrant. You have to understand that your way of doing things isn't going to be the way of doing things where you're going to be. And that they are not required to change to accommodate you. You need to change to accommodate them. And if you feel that you can't do that, then you have to go somewhere else. Otherwise, your life is going to be quite miserable. You won't accept language. You won't accept the way that they do things differently, how they hold their knife and fork, how they approach religion or whatever in their country, which is going to be different from what you're used to. I'm not saying you have to jump the line and to join them 100%, but you have to understand that you're now the different person. And like for British people, not all of us, but some people look at others and say, well, they're different and they should be like us. Like you've come to Britain, you should be British. Okay, fine. If that's the case, then when you go to Germany, do it the German way. And don't stand up and be different. And also to accept that tolerance is really healthy, really healthy. And yeah, tolerance is where it is. This experience in my life, as I've had up to recently, I'm far more tolerant than I ever used to be. And for that, I'm very happy. It's another reason why I say living in this village, I'm the happiest I've ever been.
So tolerance is healthy. Tolerate and do not judge people. Open your minds. Understand the locals. Adjust. Try not to change people. You have to adjust yourself.
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I do speak passable German. Pretty good German, actually. But with the languages of Bosnia-Herzegovina, whether that's Bosnian, Croatian or Serbian, it is a struggle at times for me. I can talk to the family about politics, right? My grammar is atrocious, but we get by, right?
Okay.
But what I'm saying is when you go somewhere different, you try in your worst possible pronunciation to order a coffee with milk. And you could say coffee with milk and point, or you could try and say it in the language of the place where you're at, knowing full well it's going to sound awful and that the pronunciation is wrong. But if you do that, watch the expression of the person that you've just asked to provide that. They immediately will say, they've tried, right? And now I'm going to help. Right down to the point that when I go out now, right, and I walk into a coffee bar, for example, or a restaurant is a good example with Tam. We're normally talking in, we've criticized each other only 48 hours ago about how we speak Serbsklish. this hybrid, this useless hybrid language that we have. In every sentence, I'm telling you, there are two Serbian words that I put into it, and we speak English to each other, right? As we go through, the waiter, the conobar, will have heard that, especially if we go somewhere strange. And they come up. And I'm talking to Tam and I say, you know, can I have a coffee? And the menu, right? And when they bring the menu back, they give me an English menu. And they're so surprised when I say, can I have a local language menu, please? Mm-hmm. Zashta, mm-hmm. Why? Because mm-hmm. I can't understand what you've written in English. Well, I can read my local language and I know what I want off the menu. And they go, oh, he's a crazy guy.
Yeah, but that's what I mean.
You have to try and just get in there somehow, even though, like me, after all these years, but people will listen and they'll understand, right? You're a language teacher and you know that.
Yeah, I love languages. So what is the most difficult word for you in the local language, Bosnia?
What is the hardest word for me?
What is the hardest, yes.
Zelenitska Stanica.
Zelenitska Stanica.
Yeah, that's it. But you understood what I said, right?
Yes.
Yeah, well, that's the hardest word. Zelenitska Stanica.
Oh, well done. If that is the hardest, you are sailing, David. You are sailing. Fantastic. Well, where will the future take you from here, David? Where do you see yourself in the future?
Well, I'm working on a project now. We rent an apartment upstairs here in the village, and it's hard work, but we're trying to get people to come and experience Bosnia-Herzegovina, the northern part of Bosnia-Herzegovina, mm-hmm. with a slow tourism mentality. So chafe, right? Slow. Mm-hmm.
Definitely chafe,
And what I want to achieve is to show more people this beautiful country so they can go away and tell everybody else that there is no longer a war here. You cannot imagine how many people in 2023 still think that there is a war on that finished at the tail end of 1995. Mm. I want people to see this, to experience this, and for local people, especially in the village where I am, to interact with foreigners so that widens their view. As well. And to finish my time here, this might sound morbid, but when Tamara and I finally got married, I said, at the end of the day, I think I've got enough money saved away that just find me a nice home, you know, when I start to dribble. And she said, well, why don't we buy a car? And I said, but no. She said, because David, we don't do homes here. We look after people right up to the end. And I went, what? And then I thought back to when I first met Tam, and there was this massive family meal, right? And there was a place at the head of the table, and this little old lady was in a wheelchair, and she sat at the end of the table. Slavenka, she didn't know what planet she was on, what day of the week it was, or anything, right? And yet she was there, not understanding or being aware of her surroundings, and everybody was talking to her as if she was, you know, like she was. And Tam said, that's what we do here. We look after our family. And I I nearly choked up when I heard that. And she said, whatever happens, that's the way it is. And so that's the world that I've come into. And that's the world that I will have when I move on.
Oh, thank you very much, David, for this fantastic conversation. I really, really loved going through your journey, through your life. And thank you so much for all the insights you've given me. Thank you very much for your story.
Well, I hope that it's been of some interest and that he has actually sat down with a coffee and, even listening to this, you know, in an armchair through your podcatcher, wherever you're listening this, you've just had, I don't know, an hour's worth of chafe. People will find it most probably, my life has not been boring and it is unusual and I wouldn't have had it and I don't want it to be any different. It's just me.
This was Two Worlds, One Me. Thank you so much for listening. Do let me know if you would like to talk about your worlds and share your story. The email is hello@twoworlds.oneme.cafe. You can also see all the details in the show notes. Come back next time. Subscribe, so you don't miss an episode. And tell your friends.
Well, there you have my story of how I came to Bosnia and Herzegovina. And I'd like to thank Slavenka so, so much for inviting me. I had a blast. And I really, really do recommend subscribing to Slavenka's amazingly interesting podcast, Two Worlds, One Me. And the link to do that is in the show notes for this episode. Please also do share this episode and maybe leave a 5-star review on the podcast platform that you listen to this on. It does help tremendously. And that's a wrap for this podcast. We hope you've enjoyed finding out a little more about both Bosnia and Herzegovina and the wider Western Balkans. If you've enjoyed this journey as much as we enjoy bringing it to you, please take a moment to leave us a review and subscribe to our podcast. Your feedback helps us tremendously and makes a huge difference. Thank you once again for joining us, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Thanks for listening to our podcast. If you would like to support us and the production of future episodes, then please consider maybe giving us a tip or becoming a member of our podcast family. The link to do that is in the show notes for this podcast. Thanks again for listening. We really do appreciate it.